Plain done on the Ideas Network. Well, politicians talk about creating jobs or killing jobs. Pundits expound on how this or that program will or won't create them. Jobs will likely be one of the deciding factors in the 2012 elections. One piece of conventional wisdom is that large companies can directly create the massive numbers of jobs needed to get our unemployment numbers back to acceptable levels. Another piece of conventional wisdom says if we could only boost our exports, this would create more jobs at home. Well, this hour we're going to talk, among other things, about whether or not these pieces of wisdom are in fact conventional or wise. Joining me for the first half hour is Daniel Gross, economics editor and columnist for Yahoo Finance. Daniel Gross, good morning and welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Well, here are some things I think we know. A lot of Americans are out of work. Some of them have been unemployed for several years. We also know that large companies are sitting on, well, pretty good-sized hills of cash, if not mountains right now, and they aren't hiring in the numbers we need to get the unemployment numbers back under control. So it seems like there's a dichotomy here that needs some explanation. Can you shed a little light on this for us?
Well, I think there are several dichotomies. You know, we have a world in which corporate America is doing fantastically. The stock market has recovered greatly since March of 2009. Corporate profits are at very high levels. They fixed their balance sheets. They're sitting on, you know, collectively, trillions of dollars in cash. And in ordinary times, you would think, okay, that would translate into more hiring because, one of the big reasons given for laying people off is, you know, our profits aren't there. If we keep everyone on our payroll, we will go bankrupt, et cetera. And I think there are sort of three or four things going on here at once. One is that, you know, when we talk about corporate profits, and we're frequently talking about the biggest companies in the U.S., those are increasingly multinational. So your Intels, your Cokes, McDonald's, they're getting 70 or 80% of their revenues and their sales from overseas. And, of course, the rest of the world economy is growing at a much more rapid rate than the U.S. And so their growth does not, you know, 30 years ago, if McDonald's and Intel were going gangbusters, that meant the U.S. economy was going gangbusters, and they'd have to hire people here to keep up with all the demand, et cetera. Now what that means is that, you know, their companies are doing really well in Asia, Africa, South America, et cetera. That does not necessarily translate into American jobs. A second thing that's going on is that American companies, you know, we like to think Americans are sort of fat and lazy and companies are slothful and stupid, et cetera, which was certainly the case in 06, 07, 08. What we've seen since the crisis occurred is American companies and the corporate sector becoming really getting religion about productivity, doing more with less or doing more with the same amount. And, you know, we've all seen the memos about, you know, using both sides of the paper when you print and you know, using Google instead of 411, et cetera. But, you know, writ large, what we've seen is, and as I travel around to factories, I visited several GE factories. I was out in North Dakota a few weeks ago where I visited a French fry factory and a oil refinery. And what you'll see at all these places, fancy machines, new machines, very few people. So companies have invested in the productivity creating software, hardware, machinery, equipment, and what that means is that they're able to do more and respond to the rising demand they're getting with fewer employees. So that's the second thing that's going on. And a third thing that is going on is what we call, you know, lean manufacturing or outsourcing, which is that, you know, time was you went to the Ford Motor plant and they were doing everything there, making every component. That company was making the boxes and that things were shipped in, et cetera. And now we have, at factories, you are assembling the stuff that's coming from elsewhere. You're keeping your headcount low, your supply chain, and the supply chain, again, could be from all over the world, is where most of the jobs are. And once again, the fact that GE may be getting more orders, the fact that Ford may be building more cars, does not translate into huge amounts of jobs directly at those companies in ways it would have 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, I want to talk about some of those factory visits you made, because you spent some time with Jeff Immelt, CEO of General Electric and chairman of President Obama's Jobs Council. What did he have to say about where the jobs are going to come from? I mean, he's supposed to be looking into this on behalf of the president. What were some of his ideas? You've shared some of the things you learned. What were some of the other things you found when you spent some time with him and toured some of their factories?
Well, you know, the reality is that this Jobs Council, you know, it does not have some sort of blueprint or study that hasn't been done about how to create jobs. And, you know, when we were sort of peppering him about that, I was with a group of journalists, and at one point he got a little agitated, and he said, look, you know, there's 1,000 speeches have been given, 1,000 studies have been given on job creation. You know, I don't have anything magic for you. GE does advanced manufacturing, right? They make gas turbines and jet engines and, you know, very expensive things that where almost all the cost is in the materials, not the labor. And GE spends a lot, you know, it's such a huge company. It has so much to gain from productivity that it has a very large R&D lab where there are a lot of people working, figuring out, you know, how do we reduce the use of, you know, this particular alloy by 2% when we make this jet engine? How can we get this done 5 minutes faster? When you tour the factories, it's all about, you know, empowering the teams of workers to come up with ideas to do things more quickly. That's how they see their profits coming. And what that all means is doing more with less material, with less labor, with less time. And, of course, that all leads to, you know, not quite as much employment. But he did tell us that, you know, again, you go, we were in this gas turbine plant where they make these gigantic, you know, gas turbines for power plants, and they're shipping them all overseas, so huge exports. But you go there, you just don't see that many people in the plant because it's so highly automated. But, you know, what he told me was, you know, every job we have on the factory floor, for every one of those, there are 8 in the supply chain. In other words, there are all these components, the people running the trains, the people delivering the products, the people who are supplying the suppliers. And so I think when you look at our big companies, you really need to be looking into their supply chain, who they are buying from, and the way in which their production and, you know, them getting new orders ripples throughout the economy. So the way sort of Immelt explained it was, you know, if we work really well on productivity, then we have a competitive cost. We go out in the world and we get orders from Saudi Arabia and India, et cetera, where we bring them back here. We may not need to hire a lot more people to make 10% more jet engines or turbines, but our suppliers, you know, will have to, and that's where the action is. So that was one of the things that I found a little illuminating. We look to the big companies to be the providers of jobs. You know, they certainly have shed a lot, but I think the reality is that they are in a better position than a smaller company to invest in productivity, to outsource, et cetera. So I think what we have to look for is ways in which the smaller companies are working with the larger companies. And I think there is something to that. You know, GE, in other words, a company that is providing GE with the ball bearings that go into a jet engine, it's not directly exporting because it's selling most of its stuff to GE. But, of course, when GE goes and wins a huge order from Airbus to send them a couple hundred jet engines, you know, it is creating a large amount of exports and is essentially, you know, a conduit through which a lot of these smaller suppliers are getting into global markets.
Well, let's talk a little bit about GE, because one of the things that I found interesting about the article you wrote about your meeting, your encounters with Mr. Immelt, was the way GE has sort of two things. One, the way they have changed themselves. They dumped NBC, they got rid of some other stuff, and really started to focus on some of the core things that built that company from the time when Thomas Edison started it. And the second thing, it was interesting to me to see that back in the 90s, Deming was worshipped, and I'm sure there were shrines all over the world to him. And we were talking about what was a continuous quality improvement and total quality improvement, and acronyms are us. I was interested to see that. I thought that kind of had been a fad and we had dumped it, but I was interested to see that in the, at least one of the factories that you visited, the organization was extremely flat, very horizontal, and it looked, it appears as though those principles have been not only maintained but refined to a great degree.
Yeah, they are still. You know, again, we think of GE, we think of NBC, and, you know, in sort of my neck of the world, New York, we think of GE Capital, which is their giant finance arm. But at root, you know, GE Capital's footprint has shrunk after the financial crisis. They've just sold more than half of NBC, and what they're left with is a lot of, you know, manufacturing. And so, yes, they are very much into, you know, whether you call it Six Sigma, total quality management, teaming, continuous improvement. The company is still very much into that. It hasn't, I don't think it ever stopped. I just think that, you know, when you have a portfolio of businesses, you know, some are always booming and some are busting, some are not doing as well. I think it happened in the last decade that sort of media and finance arms were really where a lot of the action was globally. And now, especially when you think about global growth and the fact that airlines are sprouting up around the world, that there is a huge deficit need for power plant construction in the world. You know, it is re-embracing its energy and transportation and, you know, train and solar panels, wind turbines, all that stuff, because the demand is there for that globally.
And Well, I think we need to. I need to give the phone number. That's what I forgot to do. Here's a chance for you to ask a question, Daniel Gross, about how we can create jobs and some of the things that he's observed in his travels and talks with various people involved in this sort of thing. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to the program. talk@wpr.org is the email address. And there's also a Kathleen Dunn Facebook show page. You can go there and leave a message, and we'll share it with the radio audience. And we do have a caller with us already. So let's take a call quickly before we go to a break. It's Alan in Madison. Alan, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Could your guest comment on two thoughts that I have for dealing with the unemployment situation. The first one is to reduce incentive for companies to replace their workers with machines or software and all the other technological innovations that we have. How about putting a capital assets tax on these companies, and then that tax could be used to go into a pool to reduce the deficit, or have the government create public works jobs that, you know, for all the jobs that need to be done. So that's one suggestion, a capital assets tax. And the second one would be for companies that outsource their production to countries where they can get cheaper labor, how about putting a tariff on those products that come back to us, and then those tariffs could also be used for creating or for paying for jobs that need to be done here?
Okay, well, with respect, I think the first idea of the tax on the capital assets and the idea that we should, you know, not use machines to do jobs that people used to do, you know, I think that's a very bad idea. Places that don't have mechanization and automation are very sad places in the global economy. Think back to a century ago when the percentage of Americans who worked on farms, 30, 40%. Now, of course, it's 2%. All those people were essentially liberated from backbreaking, very difficult farm work to produce food and subsistence, to go move to cities, to have mobility, to do other things, to go get educated. I visited South Africa a few years ago, and you know, you go past a construction site, and you see very little machinery or equipment, and you see 50 guys working with shovels, because you know, the labor there is $2 a day, and so the bosses figure, why bother to get a bulldozer or something when we can have people do this work? Much of the type of the work that has been replaced by machines is not the type of work anybody would wish for themselves to do, for their children to do, for their friends to do. And I think there is a certain amount of trade-off between productivity and employment in any particular place, but in the aggregate, when you look at what automation, electricity, the steam engine, all those things that helped us use machines and gain productivity, immense gains to human welfare and to our economy as a whole. On the outsourcing issue, you know, we do have to do a better job of kind of protecting people from the logic of this. This is why, you know, in our trade agreements, and this is one of the things that's holding up the approval of free trade agreements with Colombia and South Korea, is, you know, that there is assistance for people who are displaced. You know, you work at a textile plant, it goes to China, there's money paid out for, you know, training and things like that. We need that on a much larger scale, to, you know, upgrade the skills of all workers, for education. I don't think we want to set it up as a zero-sum game between, you know, we hold on to what we have, which means somebody else somewhere in the world, you know, can't move up the value chain from sort of subsistence living to working in a factory.
Alan, thanks. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Lisa in Eau Claire. Lisa, good morning.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay,
please.
Great. I just wanted the guest to comment on the report that GE paid no taxes in 2010.
So that was a big, the New York Times did a big investigation looking into the amount of taxes they paid. And again, I think, you know, this is something that was certainly discussed. I think they are trying to kind of get the image out there that, okay, maybe we do a lot of stuff to avoid paying taxes, but, you know, we employ a lot of people and all this. But I think this is also indicative of a larger problem in our business culture and in our politics, where, you know, here we are arguing about the deficit and what the cuts we're going to make, and people talking about reducing corporate taxes and not eliminating loopholes. Citizenship doesn't just mean hiring people. It doesn't just mean serving on commissions. It also means paying your fair share for the privilege of being an American-based company. And GE, like pretty much every other large corporation out there, simply doesn't do it. And they also, you know, American companies as a class, they keep offshore earnings offshore so they don't have to pay the taxes on it. And then they say, well, give us a holiday, you know, we'll bring it back if we only have to pay 10% or 5% taxes on it, which, of course, you know, just gives them incentive to take that money hostage all over again. I think what we need is not just a better tax or a simpler and better tax system, but a sense among our CEOs, of whether it's Jeff Immelt or any other corporate CEO, that your tax department shouldn't be a key component of your profit strategy. That there's nothing, you know, maybe shareholders will punish you for paying taxes, but this is a responsibility of every citizen and of every corporate citizen.
Yeah, but isn't, in terms of corporate law, isn't it the obligation of the company to maximize its profits any legal way that they can? I mean, if they stopped, you know, if they said, well, we really need to pay more taxes, wouldn't they be open to lawsuits?
Well, there's paying your taxes,
law is pretty
and
clear
there
on this.
Is, you know, spending millions of dollars a year to try to get a a piece of legislation, a line inserted in a piece of legislation that only benefits your company, or fighting tooth and nail against the elimination of a tax loophole, while at the same time complaining about the deficit. In other words, the people at the business roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce and all these other business organizations are complaining about the deficit, they're complaining about the tax code, and yet they are the same ones who are, you know, corrupting it and influencing its complexity with their campaign donations. So, yes, I mean, if you are a person and you're able to take the home mortgage deduction, you should take the home mortgage deduction. But there's a difference between that and, you know, taking a big chunk of your fortune and essentially paying legislatures through campaign donations so that they will insert a phrase in the piece of legislation that, you know, says only you don't have to pay a certain tax.
Well, I want to get back to the jobs thing, because that's, I know you have to leave very quickly. And before you go, I want to just ask you one more question. So if we can't look to the big companies to hire all the people we need to fix this unemployment problem, because after all, they can make more money by being more efficient, where is the hope that we can get people back to work? Does it lie with making sure that these big companies are profitable so that they continue to use the supply chain and these small businesses are going to be the engine of growth?
Well, I think it's a few things. One is, yes, we should want our companies to do well and get more business all over the world, because in the case of GE and in the case of many other companies, some of that global, you know, that is the conduit through which global demand flows back here. It's very difficult for a 10-person, machine tool shop in Wisconsin to be doing business in Kazakhstan. But it's easier for them to be doing business with a supplier to GE who is, you know, working on projects that are coming through there. And the second is, so, you know, that's one. The second is, I think every company at every level has to think more seriously about ways to get involved in global markets and in the sectors that are doing well because of global markets, right? Agriculture is doing extremely well. Logistics is doing extremely well. All these things that are tethered to the movement of goods and services around the world, driven by higher and stronger demand from overseas, tend to do well. So, you know, if you are an employee or a company thinking about ways you can get involved in that. But at root, it's really about, and not to get all Keynesian about this, it's really about demand. Businesses will hire a restaurant, I would say people may be stupid, but they're not dumb. They don't not hire people out of spite. If they think they can make more money by hiring people, they will. If you're a restaurant and you are finding that, you know, you're turning 25 people away for dinner every night, you will hire a couple other people to help meet that demand. But the demand has to materialize first. And what's happening is, so far, demand has generally been muted, especially consumer demand, and this is, you know, it's a circular thing. The employment situation is bad. People don't feel comfortable spending. We are getting the talk in Washington and in state governments is about budget cuts. I mean, all these, you know, these government shutdowns, all those create demand shocks, which mitigates against hiring. And so, you know, I think the real answer lies in, if we're looking to government, what can it do to encourage greater consumer demand? One thing is sort of remove the uncertainty of people who think they're going to lose their jobs or not be able to have their businesses because of, you know, politicians' disagreements about budgets and things like that. And a second is to look at our safety net, unemployment benefits, to look at tax system. What can the government be doing to encourage people to go out and spend? Americans have been saving a lot of money. They've been paying down debt. I'm not talking about your on average, but in aggregate, people are spending more with cash instead of plastic. There is a certain amount of pent-up demand, but people are feeling in a kind of conservative mood with their personal finances, and it's very circular. If you don't spend, then I won't hire. If you will spend, then I will hire. If I hire, then you will spend. So I think part of it is in resolving some of this uncertainty, stepping back from kind of this apocalyptic rhetoric about shutdowns and elimination and massive layoffs in the government sector. Part of it is people having a kind of collective leap of confidence, a leap of faith, be willing to say, you know, I'm going to hire someone slightly ahead of the demand because I think I don't want to miss it if it comes, or my profits are such that I can maybe afford to hire one other person this year, that sort of process.
Okay. I know you have to leave. I really appreciate you spending this time with us this morning. Daniel Gross, thank you very much.
Anytime. Happy to do it.
Daniel Gross is economics editor and columnist for Yahoo Finance. Chrissy Pease arranged this segment of the program and handled on-air production. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about another piece of this economic puzzle, the import-export piece. We're still talking about jobs, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Robert Scott, Director of Trade and Manufacturing Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute, and he's an expert on imports and exports and how they affect the job market. You can call in with your questions for him at 800-486-8655 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. By the way, you can find the most recent economic coverage from Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, talk shows, news reports, interviews, and more at WisconsinMoneyMatters.org. It's a special website we've set up, WisconsinMoneyMatters, all one word, .org. And that will give you access to all sorts of news and interviews about the economy. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:34. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Coming up later on today on the Ideas Network, well, traditionally, the ideal family consisted of two children, hopefully a boy and a girl, according to Ben Maron's Guest After Five. Many parents are now choosing to raise a single child. Join the conversation about the myths and benefits of raising an only child. That's After Five today, At Issue with Ben Maron's. This hour we're talking about the economy. And we just finished a conversation with Daniel Gross about, what's it going to take to get jobs back in this country? We certainly have a huge unemployment problem. And bottom line is there's actually a demand problem, and that at the end of the day seems to be what will move this economic needle one way or another. We're going to talk, though, now for the next 25 minutes or so, about another aspect of this economic puzzle with Robert Scott, Director of Trade and Manufacturing Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. Robert Scott, good morning, and thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, pretty good so far, but the day is young.
It is.
We have to leave some room for the unexpected.
Absolutely.
Okay, so every politician and every coffee shop pundit is talking about jobs. Way back in February, President Obama talked about the need to increase U.S. exports in order to create jobs. And intuitively, I mean, just hearing that, that sounds pretty good. Yeah, if we could only sell more goods to other countries, that would mean more Americans were at work. Is that, in fact, the case?
Intuitively, it might make some sense if you just think about exports alone. The problem is there's two sides to the trade equation. There are exports and there are imports. Exports support domestic jobs, imports displace them. We got two problems with that kind of trade. In the first 5 months of this year, exports increased 16.5%. You think that sounds great, right? We're winning. We should be creating some jobs. Unfortunately, imports increased faster. They increased 18.8%. So that's the first problem with trade. Imports are growing faster than exports. The second problem is that we import totally about 40% more manufactured goods than we export. So in order just to keep the trade deficit from growing, exports have to grow 40% faster than imports. There's no way we can run fast enough across that thin ice to avoid plunging into the cold lake. job loss, and that's the problem we've got. So just increasing exports alone is not going to get it done.
So there's almost sort of a push-me-pull-you relationship then between exports and imports, in a way.
Absolutely. We have to stimulate exports and do something about the flood of imports coming into this country.
Well, by choice or design or by accident, who knows? But our entire economy has shifted away from manufacturing. We had great times with lots of easy credit, and we just started buying stuff instead of making stuff. Do we have the manufacturing base that we would need to turn this around?
We don't have it today. We have lost about a third of our manufacturing capacity. We can recapture and rebuild that, but it's going to be take an effort akin to putting a man on the moon or building the U.S. interstate highway system. It's not going to be an easy job. It's going to take investment, and it's going to take clear thinking and planning.
Investment by whom?
It's going to take investment by both the public and the private sector. The public sector is going to have to invest, for example, in infrastructure to rebuild our roads and bridges and railroads so that they can carry traffic more efficiently. That, by the way, will also create demand for manufactured goods. We also need investment by private manufacturers in manufacturing. They're not spending right now.
We just heard Daniel Gross talking about his visits with GE and touring factories and how they're modernizing and making themselves more efficient, more productive. They can do more stuff with fewer workers. But he also spoke about how the supply chain is where the jobs are. And if you're in that supply chain, you have to have an efficient way to get your products up the chain. That seems to be where the manufacturing growth opportunities really are, is maybe in the smaller manufacturers rather than some big, say, GM factory someplace making, you know, big, huge cars or something like that. Maybe the way to go here is to encourage the medium and smaller manufacturers, because they will be the ones that can really have the hiring capacity.
I'm afraid that's getting too close to picking winners and losers. I think we have to step back and ask, why have we lost a third of our manufacturing capacity, and what can we do to change that? The major reason why is that other countries, especially China and other countries in Asia, have been taking advantage of us by manipulating their currencies and employing lots of other unfair trade practices to basically steal manufacturing jobs from the United States. For example, China keeps its currency undervalued by at least 30%, according to most economic research. That means that's as though they're applying a subsidy of 30% to every single product that they export, and an extra tax of 30% on every good that we ship to China or any other country where we compete with China. So it has global implications, this currency manipulation problem. They also pour tens of billions of dollars of subsidies into a wide range of industries. We've looked in my institute at steel, at paper. We have a study. We've looked at glass, and we have a study of auto parts. Each of these sectors has seen subsidies on the order of $25 to $30 billion over the last decade, from the Chinese government to U.S. and other foreign manufacturers. We can't compete with that kind of unfair trade.
So I thought that the WTO was supposed to be there to fix these types of problems. This isn't new. I mean, we've known about this for years. Why has this been such an intractable problem?
Well, the WTO process is very flawed. It takes a long period of time to file an individual case at the WTO. But more importantly, you have to have somebody who's willing to file a complaint. 20 years ago, U.S. companies were willing to file those complaints in about unfair trade practices. Before that was before the WTO, we could just file them here in the United States and not have to bother with the WTO. But in the last 10 or 15 years, what's happened is most large companies have globalized. They have moved more of their production offshore. Just like GE, the company that was the subject of Mr. Gross's interview last week, that company has seen a tremendous drop in the share of its employment in the U.S. It's gone down from about over half of its employment to it's dropped about 5 percentage points in the last decade. But it's even much, much bigger drop in manufacturing employment. Most of the jobs that kept her were in non-manufacturing sectors.
I want to go back to something, and we've got some callers who want to join us, and I want to get to those calls in just a moment. By the way, there's room for you to call right now at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address talk@WPR.org. I want to go back to something, Robert Scott, that you referred to earlier. You talked about the need for us here in the United States to invest in infrastructure, given the atmosphere, the political atmosphere in Washington and in the 50 states. How likely is it that we're going to see that kind of investment? That seems to be anathema to, the freshman class in Congress, people saying the government has to spend less, we need private industry to do everything. So the government needs to just get out of the way. What are the prospects that someone's going to say, hey, if we want private industry to be able to do what they do, we've got to make sure that the roads, the railroads and the highways and the bridges and things aren't falling apart. There seems to be a kind of I don't know if it's a false dichotomy, but there certainly is a conflict there.
It would appear that there is. I think right now, our political system has become almost dysfunctional in Washington. We've wasted close to 6 months now fighting about this debt ceiling thing, which used to be an almost automatic measure. Whenever the government needed to raise the debt ceiling, Congress just passed the necessary bill. But the Republicans have chosen to turn it into battle to the death to try and shrink the size of government, which I think is the problem. But I think infrastructure has to be viewed differently. Infrastructure is something that we pay for as we go, and it's usually paid for with revenue bonds, paid for with things like taxes on gasoline or jet fuel or railroad diesel fuel, and there has never been a cheaper time in history to sell revenue bonds. Right now, you can sell treasury bills for short-term treasury bills for much less than 1% per year. You can sell 5 or 10-year treasury bills for less than 3% per year. That's like giving money away. So I think we should seriously consider setting up infrastructure funds. There have also been proposals for revolving funds that could be set up by the government. And I think once we get past this deficit and debt ceiling crisis here in Washington, that may set the stage for talking about jobs, because I think jobs do remain the public's number one concern, even in the midst of all this talk about deficit cutting.
All right, let's go to the phones. The phone lines are full. We'll start in Three Lakes and hear what Dan has to say. Dan, good morning. What's on your mind?
Relative to the Chinese question and their manipulating their currency, couldn't we absolutely solve that problem from our end on our own initiative if we just imposed a tariff on things imported from China? And at the same time, however, if we did so, wouldn't that also cause inflation in this country? And I'll listen off the air.
Thank you. Good question. We absolutely could solve the problem with China and its currency manipulation. All we have to really do is threaten them with a tariff. The last time we did that in 2005, they immediately let their currency rise by about 20% over three years. So that would be a good start. We never actually imposed a tariff. The Senate just passed a measure that said that they would allow it. Never got out of the House, never got to the president. That's typically the way these things go. China is so dependent on exports to the U.S. that once we showed them that we had some backbone, they will respond. They will back down and revalue their currency because, in part, it's in their own best interest. In terms of inflation, I don't think that's going to be much of a problem. When China did revalue in 2005, it had very little effect on import prices. And the imports that we do buy from China only make up, less than half of 1% of everything we buy in this country. Most of what we buy, we make here. So it's not a problem, not going to be a problem for inflation. It will be a problem for international relations with the Chinese. And they'll make a lot of noise, and they'll get their friends on Wall Street to make noise here, and that's the problem. Those are the people who will oppose taking action on currency with China.
Dan, thanks for the call. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have more callers who want to join us. My guest is Robert Scott. We're talking about how exports and imports impact this whole discussion about jobs. By the way, if you would like to keep up on all of the coverage of the economy, on everything from your own personal finances to the federal deficit to jobs, imports, exports, whatever, we have a website we'd like to direct you to. It's called WisconsinMoneyMatters.org. That's WisconsinMoneyMatters, all one word, .org. And that website contains a lot of great information about the economy. We'll be back to talk more with Robert Scott in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes before 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. In this hour, we're talking about jobs. We started out talking about how major corporations, what their role is in job creation. Now we're talking a little bit, taking a little bit different angle, talking about exports and imports and how they affect the job market here in the United States. My guest is Robert Scott, Director of Trade and Manufacturing Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. We have a lot of callers who want to join the discussion, so let's go right back to the phones. We'll start with Ifosa in Madison. Good morning, and thank you for joining us. And I don't hear Ifosa. Are you there? I'm still not hearing him. Well, let's go to Rebecca in Soldiers Grove instead. Rebecca, good morning.
Hello. I can barely hear you. Something happened to the line. Maybe I can just quickly say my question. Listening to your guest talk about the manipulations by China in the American economy, I wonder at the motivation behind U.S. politicians that they turn and try to destroy American labor, crushing unions and saying that people make too much money to try and take advantage of this situation. I'll take my answer off there because I can't hear you at all.
Okay, Rebecca, thanks a lot. Robert Scott?
Well, I think what's happened, again, in the last 10 or 20 years is there's been a large concentration of wealth in the hands of big multinational companies. They've taken over a big part of our trade. They're now, I think, they're responsible for over half of all trade. They're also generating a huge share of corporate profits. In the last few years, they've been allowed to channel those profits directly into U.S. Election campaigns in the week of a Supreme Court decision a couple of years ago. So that has really changed the structure of politics in this country. I'm afraid that in this case, money is really driving the process, and especially corporate money, and they like to see low wages, and they want to keep those cheap subsidized factories in China open, and they don't want us to do anything about the currency.
Well, one of the interesting things is there have been some news reports coming out over the last 6 months or so. Wages are going up in China. They may not be the low-cost manufacturer for much longer.
Well, I think China is aware of that, and China has been moving with a vengeance out of industries like textiles and apparel and footwear, where wages are really most important, and into higher tech sectors like semiconductors and electronics and clean energy technology, where and they're developing new technologies in China that they're selling to us. So they are responding very quickly, and they're investing literally hundreds of billions of dollars in building up new industries in China to compete with the U.S. So they're going to let those low-tech industries go offshore to countries like Vietnam and Sri Lanka and into Africa, where wages are much, much lower. They're already making that adjustment.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. Let's go to Pete, who is on the road. Pete, good morning.
Hi. How about if we went to a fair tax and where the product is taxed, not the companies, then our companies would have a big advantage where the overseas companies have to pay for the shipping, where our companies, the product would be already here.
Well, I think that's an important point. Almost every other country in the world, including China and all of Europe and most of Asian countries, have what's called a value-added tax. It's essentially a sales tax. The difference is, under the WTO rules, that tax can be rebated at the border. In other words, they get the tax money back. The tax money in Europe, for example, is used to pay for health care. That kind of a deal would help U.S. manufacturers in two ways. It would pay for their health care, and it would relieve them of that burden when they exported a product to the rest of the world. I think that's an excellent idea, one we ought to be talking about. I think tax reform has got to be part of this debate.
Pete, thanks for that call, and be safe on the road out there. Let's Well, I just you mentioned the role of multinationals in the context of imports and exports and jobs and so forth, and that really has been the game changer. I mean, when we think about the traditional factory, it might have been locally owned. The factory owner may have been somebody that you saw in the grocery store and maybe saw in church on Sunday morning. But that really isn't the case for any industry you could name here in the U.S., is it?
No, it's not. And there's been a fundamental change, particularly among U.S.-owned multinationals like GE and Caterpillar. 20 years ago, it was true that those companies created more jobs at home than they did abroad. However, in the last decade, according to a report that just came out of the U.S. Department of Commerce, what has happened is that these big companies have been cutting employment at home and adding employment abroad. In the last decade, according to a Wall Street Journal story in April, U.S. Companies added 2.4 million jobs overseas, and they cut 2.9 million jobs in the United States. So big switch, and that trade and that pattern matches what happened in trade. 20 years ago, U.S. multinationals had a big trade surplus. They mostly invested in places like Europe where they sold products. Now, those same companies have a trade deficit, and again, that's costing us jobs here in the United States. I don't blame these companies per se. I think the policies are encouraging them to do this, and that's the problem.
Well, let's we only have about a minute. In fact, we have exactly a minute, and I want to try to wrap this up. Kind of summarize for us what you think are some of the maybe the top two or three things we could do to solve this problem. You mentioned developing our own infrastructure. We've talked a little bit about tax policy. Kind of encapsulate that for us as we leave you today.
Thank you. The number one thing we have to do is to convince China and other currency manipulators in Asia to stop making their currencies artificially cheap. then I think we do need to also tackle unfair trade policies like subsidies and dumping. I think we need a new way to do that so that the government can file cases and not wait for companies or to file the cases on their own behalf. And I think finally, as you mentioned, we need to invest in not just infrastructure, but R&D to help create the new products to sell to the rest of the world.
All right. Well, that seems to be a great place to leave it then. Thank you for that summary. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for the chance. Enjoy talking with you as well.
Robert Scott, Director of Trade and Manufacturing Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. And by the way, I want to mention this again because we're talking about the economy. If you would like to get the latest coverage of local, state, and national issues related to the economy, you can go to our new website, WisconsinMoneyMatters.org. That's WisconsinMoneyMatters, all one word, .org, and get that information. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can go to WPR.org, go to the Kathleen Dunn page, and later on today you'll be able to listen to it if you missed part of it. The program was produced by Chrissy Pease, who also handled on-air production. Stick around another hour to go here on the Kathleen Dunn program. I am John Munson, filling in for Kathleen Dunn for the next couple of weeks here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.